This conference will now be recorded.
There. Okay, I invited Matt because I watch what goes on in my area, you know, about ethics, municipal ethics, and Matt is a star for the towns around us. And I said, this is a guy who I think takes it seriously. And besides that, he's the chair of the COG. And he can also explain to us a little bit about what COG does, what they are doing. Are all the COGs in synchronization? Do they, or do they each have their own way of running things? And then that's when you other two who don't know anything about COGs can ask your questions.
Okay. Mary, thank you very much for those kind words. Yes, I'm currently serving as chair of the South Central Regional Council of Governments board. And largely, the Council of Governments is a sub-political body that was created in order to facilitate the distributions of state and federal funds, particularly as it relates to transportation and regional planning. Those are the COGs are the regional planning groups as defined under state statute. So many of the COGs have dipped into providing a variety of support services for the members. And those services range from a service we recently provided to our membership was consultants on how to develop our affordable housing plans. They are in the middle of our COG is in the middle of a solid waste management initiative to try to reduce solid waste by taking food scraps out and composting things along those lines. They also provide some services related to grant writing and some expertise around purchasing and purchasing policies. But largely, the organization exists to interface with the Department of Transportation on transportation-related issues, traffic and corridor studies, and also, as I said, the distribution of what is known as LOTSIP, which is local transportation investment program. And that is that's a methodology whereby funds become available in each region, and there's an equitable process for distribution amongst the respective members of each of the COGs. So the degree to which those ancillary services exist really reflects the composition or the nature of each of the COGs. Greater Hartford COG is a very, very well-developed COG, and they have consortium purchasing agreements, and they do a variety of things that you wouldn't think a regional planning association would do. So again, in large measure, it is related primarily to transportation, but there are other avenues of support that are being provided to the member communities. It is supported through a dues structure, which is population based, at least for the South Central region. It's a contribution per capita, and I think some others do it a little bit differently. There may be a base rate and then a per capita on top of that to ensure that everybody is paying their fair share. We are probably going to be looking at our dues structure. The bulk of the funding to operate the COGS comes from these regional service grants, which are the planning grants that come down from the state, and that's usually included in the state's annual budget, and there's an allocation given to each of the COGS. So that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of the COGS. Each municipality served by the COG has a representative. It's traditionally the CEO of each of those communities is automatically a board member. And again, there in the case of our COG, we have a transportation subcommittee, which is comprised of some of the CEOs as well as most of the town engineers who are responsible for transportation planning. So that's kind of it. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and if they're really tricky, I may have to make up an answer. So.
Well, Matt, I'm sure that Mary filled you in on what our mission is.
She did. She did, and it was delightful to actually sit in a room with Mary again after so many of those COG meetings over time prior to COVID, when we disbanded the in person. Although we're back in person now, so it was good to see her. I have some questions, and by the way, Mary, as promised, I talked to Carl Amento, and I don't know if he's reached out to you yet, but I said to him that I was somewhat dismayed by the fact that you had been trying to get in touch with him and had not gotten a response. So I'll make sure I circle back with him again after this meeting. But have you had a chance to talk to Carl directly?
No.
Okay.
City director for the transit district.
Okay.
And that doesn't work.
Okay. But I did have a brief conversation with him, and I suggested that he needed to engage with you just to round out the edges on this, particularly since he is our representative to the group that meets. All the COG executive directors meet on a somewhat regular basis. I believe it's once a month. So, you know, this socialization of this issue would probably rise to their level. So it might not surprise you, I did a little bit of homework based on the materials that you had supplied to me, Mary. And I believe it is 13 of the 14 municipalities in the South Central Regional Council of Governments have an ethics policy in place. Most of them were either they were defined in ordinance or charter. Some have a combination of both. So, you know, the fact that 13 of the 14 communities within our COG begs, I think, a primary question, and that is, what would the role of a regional ethics board or ethics code, if, and that, these are some of the questions I have for you, what would the role be beyond the role that's already being provided in these, 13 municipalities out of the 14. And I did a little further, and I think there, if by my count, 31% of the 169 towns do not have an ethics code or ethics policy in place, which constitutes about 18% of the municipalities statewide. Now, you guys can certainly talk to the efficacy of some of those boards and those policies and those boards and whether or not they work. So again, let's go back to my primary question. And again, I don't mean to be a wise guy, but for a district like or a region like COG, the SCROG rather, is this a solution in looking for a problem? So I guess I'd like to understand how you would envision it working with a COG like ours, where, as I said, 13 of the 14 have it. The only one is that does not is Bethany, and that's largely because they're probably the smallest municipality in our footprint. If you guys could socialize to me what you would see as the structure and the role and how it would either supplant, enhance, or create a secondary a process for adjudicating ethics complaints.
Mary, do you want to start?
Okay. Of all those towns, how many of them have met in the last year? That was one of our concerns. They have them on on paper, but are they using them? And if they aren't using them, why?
Well, I don't have that data at my command. It's certainly something that could be done in a survey fashion through the COG, if and we can direct Carl to do that. I will talk directly to Guilford. Guilford's board meets somewhat regularly. In fact, the board just recently completed a revision to our ethics code. They made some revisions to the code, which were codified by the Board of Selectmen in a town meeting, and then eventually by the Board of Selectmen. So they meet they meet probably quarterly or more often as needed. There have not been a significant number of ethics complaints. I don't think there's been one complaint that has risen to the board since I've been sitting in this seat. I do know that there have been occasional, over time, there are occasional requests for interpretation on potential conflicts of interest, as opposed to ethics violations and complaints. So I think in Guilford's patch, it has been largely individuals looking to get involved in some board or commission, or are on an elected board looking for some clarification on potential conflict of interest or violation of some of the policies in the ethics commission. Fortunately, Guilford is not one of those communities who would welcome the opportunity to weaponize for political purposes an ethics code, which I do know happens elsewhere in the state. It has been used to try to exact some pound of flesh out of the out of political appointments. I dare say that's probably very minimal, but I am aware. Well, I don't know the cases specifically, but I've recall some communities where that has happened. So, in terms of who's doing, which of the communities are actively engaged in it and are actually promoting it, I wouldn't be able to do that. So, if you guys wanted to put together some form of a questionnaire relative to the data sets that you're looking for, I'd be happy to move that forward with Carl and have him send that out in the form of a survey.
Cheryl, we can't hear
Matt,
you.
If I might ask a question, you just used the word weaponize.
Yep.
It says I'm green.
You're good. We hear you, Cheryl.
Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
You just used the word weaponize. Do you think, in your opinion, that by having a municipal ethics board, that's how it would in general be viewed by the communities? It's a way of doing a gotcha.
I don't think so. I wouldn't say that would be prevalent, or that would be the predominant vision or understanding or interpretation of why the ethics codes exist. But they do exist to exact a measure of revenge on and to settle political scores. Again, I can't put my fingers on that, but I do recall, I've been a student of government for quite some time, having been on the board of selectmen now for 5 years and 26 years on a board of finance here in town. So, fortunately, it has not happened here, in terms of people weaponizing it. But I seem to recall that it has been done. I wouldn't say it's the predominant or the prevailing view of the communities, respective communities. Smart political operatives can weaponize almost anything if they really want to.
I wouldn't call them smart. I would call them evil.
If North Branford has never used theirs, I know there's enough that going on out there they should have.
Many years ago, I met with the first selectman of Madison, who had disbanded their ethics board because it had been used as a weapon. They eventually reconstituted it. I don't know what the current state is. I haven't spoken to them in quite some time.
I believe Madison's at least on your list that they do have the code, the ethics code and policy in place. And it is Board of Selectmen policy. So at that point, that traditionally means it's at the whim of a respective Board of Selectmen, but it doesn't mean that they're actually utilizing it or weaponizing it.
But one of our goals is to try and stabilize or make uniform the codes of conduct from municipality to municipality so that everyone is working under basically the same rules. And we know it's not a one size fits all, but with certain tenets that really need to be built in as base, a good foundation for the entire board. And would you think that that would be an easier or hard sell?
This the land of steady habits and 169 individual fiefdoms, well, there will always be a challenge relative to getting something that everybody's going to agree on. But I think theoretically, there should be a base level of ethical behavior that is adhered to. Now, each individual community can differ on, let's say, the size of the value of gifts. You know, could be $15, it could be $50, it could be $100, right? And I think you know, there could certainly be some flexibility there, unless you were to model it after the state model, which I don't know if that's effective or not. But
hi, Matt. Again, thank you for coming. For the record, I noticed on the screen it displays Ann Morgan. So I'm not Ann Morgan.
I didn't think so.
Peter Lewandowski, the executive director. So
yeah.
What we're trying to do, or at least our discussions up until now, have been to address, obviously, concerns of weaponizing ethics complaints, of politicizing governmental ethics, particularly on the enforcement side of things, when folks file a complaint. And one concept that was raised was to have COGS have for enforcement purposes, whether it's for an appeal or for the first review, is to have to remove a matter, a complaint, and have a COG or members, or let's say a committee formed by COGS, ethics committee, that would review the complaint that's been filed, and let's use Guilford, for example. So you have independent folks, unrelated to anyone in Guilford, who could review the complaint that's been filed and determine whether it has legs to stand on. And if not, if it's outside of jurisdiction, whatever the reason, if it's bogus complaint, if it's really a political hatchet job, dismiss it. And it removes that element of politics from the town. That's one way of dealing with it. I don't know what are your thoughts on that?
Your point's very well taken, Peter. For instance, our ethics board is an appointed board. That board and appointed by the Board of Selectmen. It's not an elected position, so. Clearly, I will say it has not happened here. The board is constituted. We have a bare majority rule here in Guilford, which requires that the majority on a board have no more than one vote or one seat more than the aggregate of the other parties. Stacking a board with like-minded individuals who support a political agenda is rather difficult to do. It's not impossible. Doesn't mean you can't find sympathetic. I couldn't find sympathetic Republicans or disaffected Republicans who are Republicans, but basically as registration only, right? So I think there will always be a nature of some. A political I don't want to say taint, but some political influence based on the appointment process for a community like Guilford and others. I will say that, the bare majority rule has probably precluded that from happening over time. And quite honestly, the members of the board have typically not been political actors of any shape or form. There are a couple of it right now. Our board is constituted by at least two attorneys, maybe three attorneys. Doesn't mean attorneys aren't politically active, but these don't happen to be. And another gentleman on the board is our chair of the fire commission. So it's a pretty well balanced board at this point, which I don't think really looks at this in a political lens. So, but clearly, the opportunity for that to have a political taint certainly exists. Whereas if you're doing it in an independent third party, it might not have that.
So following Peter's line of his question, and Peter, that was perfectly stated, do you think, I'm going to go back to something personal. If in fact you have a board, and I believe, Matt, you said in Guilford it is appointed?
It's an appointed board, yes.
Okay. So if there are seven people on a board and one more person, so it's 4-3, whether it be Republican, Democrat, Independent, right. Do you also have the ability for the first selectman or the chair of the board to cast a tie-breaking vote if you needed the majority to vote on an issue or to say no to an issue?
No, the first selectman is ex officio on every board and commission in town, but it's ex officio, no voting rights.
Ah, interesting. That's very good.
It is. Yeah.
You know, it seems so simple, but who would have thought that would be one of the, I'll say, prerequisites to it? That makes total sense.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So if we try to take this a step further, is there a neutral way? I mean, we have come up with some things, and when we first formed, I know I, as well as some of the other members, reached out to some of the municipalities to get information on their ethics policies and getting an ethics code in place. And some were receptive, some were a little bit less than receptive. And I think some of the questions were, we don't have a problem, we don't need this. So even if you don't have a problem, if we were, as we're trying to take it away from the individual municipalities to a neutral zone for discussion, how would you go about doing that to make it more accessible, to agreeable and amenable for the people?
Yeah, when you say people, you're talking about the political actors or the constituents?
Well, it could be both, but the political actors.
I'm going to dare say, I dare say that probably 95%+ of the member of the community of Guilford is unaware that we have an ethics code or board. That's just the people not paying attention to what's going on in this world, and we have a pretty high level of, and it's pretty engaged community, but we have 15% of our population shows up to vote on our budget referendum every year. So that just tells you, you know, how much people are paying attention to what's going on in town, you know. But, you know, we tend to get, you know, a tremendous turnout for, you know, general elections and presidential elections. But I'd be surprised if more than 5 or 10% were aware that we had an ethics code in place or in effect at the time. So that probably begs the question, why aren't we promoting that more often and making folks more aware that that avenue exists for folks who might think that there's a potential ethics problem. Yeah, it's a good question. But.
What would
so Peter,
do?
Where do we go from here?
One
well,
more.
Matt already knows. I mean, I think we had, because Mary forwarded some of the information to you, our initial attempt, we surveyed all the towns. We had overwhelming response. Of course, we had few that did not respond to our survey. We obviously met with CCM and COST. Our initial approach has been to require adoption of an ethics code by every town in the state. So the residents at least have some kind of guideposts to, so and they understand when they interact with the town officials or town employees, they know what to expect. Now, I agree with you. I think civic participation is lacking on many, even in a town like yours that's active, you still have a substantial segment of the population that doesn't really participate. And you can probably post your code of ethics right under the town logo, and still they won't visit the website because the interest is lacking. At the same time, you know, the concern is, well, you know, if we advertise it out there, will it attract some gadflies, people who are, you know, the very few who are just have nothing else to do. And I think that concern, I mean, we have those on the state level too. Yeah. And we have a process where we can dismiss bogus complaints, bogus inquiries and so on. But you know, our attempt to have every town adopt the code of ethics, I think, was done with the intent to raise the awareness. I think you cited the statistics that about, I think, close to 30 or about 30 still do not have it. It's been frustrating. Proposal that we've moved along has got stalled in the House. And by the way, the proposal to have every town adopt a code of ethics was done in a way that it would not sound like a mandate or imposition on towns, but rather towns would be in the driver's seat and would be responsible for crafting their own code of ethics. We would be available to help. That didn't go anywhere. And so now we're looking at the approach, well, maybe COGS, maybe potential, maybe a pilot project, maybe have a number of towns who want to volunteer and take a regional approach. That's where we are. I don't know if board members want to add something to what I just said, but we're looking at different avenues. We've looked at some, we've attempted a couple times to have different initiatives. And it's important. I mean, we constantly get inquiries from town residents frustrated that they don't have an outlet. And I'm not talking, again, there's a good number of towns in the state that do it really well. But there are many others that do not. And we have a good vantage point here as an Office of State Ethics to see what's going on, where there are these gaps, what could more be done to enhance ethics in our state, governmental ethics. Yeah,
Peter, you encapsulated everything very well, but there's another side that comes into it sometimes, and that is complaints that don't get addressed. And I think that getting into a regional ethics board might help that. And I know for a fact, because such an event happened to me well before I came on the ethics board. I had been vice chair of the employee retirement board here in Fairfield. An election was held. I was supporting a candidate. He lost. within a week of the new selectman being sworn in, I got a call from the secretary telling me that I was not being renewed. And I asked to talk to the selectman. No, he's not available. Ran into him at a charity event 2 months later. And he told me point blank, it was because I had supported his opponent. That's why he removed me from the board. Well, the next election cycle, he was having a fundraiser with a comedian my wife wanted to see. So she gave him a contribution, went to it. And a week later, I got a note from him with a handwritten note at the top of this form letter saying that he'd love my support and he'd be more than happy to put me on a town board or commission for that support, which is quid pro quo. And I took it to the ethics board here in Fairfield and they would do nothing with it because they thought it was just too hot a political issue and they didn't want to touch it. So he got away with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's one reason that I think having an outlet other than just having each community police itself, that's where you can get into the problem of it being weaponized. But it also can be a problem where people are too afraid to do something.
Right. Agreed. So my question is would this be an appeal process beyond, so if you were unsatisfied with what happened in Fairfield, would you envision this regional or even a statewide appeal process be something that you would have been willing to do or would have liked to have had the opportunity to do that, to take it beyond Fairfield?
If the state had jurisdiction, I would have taken it to the state.
Okay. So what legal recourses would you have had? Do you know?
I don't think there was any legal recourse other than ethics. An ethics investigation done by the town of Fairfield's ethics board. But they didn't want to handle it, so there was no, and I was not going to make a federal case out of it. But I just thought it was wrong and that something that should have been addressed.
Yeah.
I think part of the reluctance for towns to, I think that's probably, you know, your head too. I think the concerns is when you have complaints, ethics complaints, there's obviously cost involved. There's no doubt. You know, the town has to retain attorneys and so on. So there is a process that could be costly and it's something that we are very much aware of. I mean, we can cite a number of examples in other towns where some of the cases that were heavily litigated ended up to be a big hit on the town budget. You know, we've even suggested, I think in the past, I think we've had a proposal several years ago where the whole enforcement mechanism would be inherited by this agency, by the Office of State Ethics. Now, obviously, that didn't go far because of in the land of steady habits, I think everyone is very protective of the town rule or home rule. And it was just seen as another mandate, which again, we're cognizant of that. That's why we've tailored some of our subsequent proposals with that recognition that towns will have a greater say in how they run their ethics boards and how they deal with ethics complaints.
Yeah, I think you're going to see a bunch of folks that, you know, the classic home rule stuff. No, we can take care of it in our own community. Will probably be the predominant viewpoint. It would be my suspicion. I'm curious as to how my friends at CCM and COST responded to some of these same issues when you brought them up. And first, the first question was, had CCM or COST taken a position, and I should probably know this, I don't recall them taking a position on the legislation that you guys were looking to pass, which stalled in the House. Did either of them pick that up as part of their platform, or suggest that they would talk to the membership about support for that for that legislation?
So both CCM and COST, when we initially proposed the bill that would require every town to adopt a code of ethics, we actually worked on the language. It was a negotiated language with CCM and COST to allow towns to be in the driver's seat in tailoring their code of ethics. I think absolutely CCM and COST had a legitimate concern that they didn't want you know, provisions that would be more applicable to big cities suddenly ending up in small town codes of ethics. So with that recognition, we tailored a kind of a compromise, a language to which we all agreed, and it passed in the Senate. Actually, I would have to check the exact thing, and I'll check that shortly. But I know it. We had issues in the House, and it did not advance. Now, both CCM and COST supported the language in the committee, GAE committee. They testified. I think CCM testified in support of that compromise language. And I know in the past, other bills that we've proposed, the ones where, like, for example, that enforcement bill, they were opposed to it, simply, again, because of their membership concerned about the home rule issue. So they conveyed this to us. But I think we're trying to find a common ground, and we've had a few attempts. I mean, we have a good, I think, rapport. They know that we're not going to ram this in any way. We want to work with them and get their input and support from their membership. And of course, they recognize and they noted to us that there will be some members who will be opposed to anything, to particularly the ones who don't have ethics codes. But it's been a positive development, because ever since that initial proposal, I think we've had few towns that have already adopted codes of ethics. So it's moving in the right direction, but ideally it would be great if most towns had something on their books, at least to provide some guidance to the residents.
Yeah, I would agree. I quite honestly, I think it's a dereliction of responsibility for administrations if they don't have something in place. How else do you tell your employees and your board and commission members what's appropriate behavior and how to act appropriately? You know, I think you hit the nail on the head. As I looked at the list that don't have it, it is clearly all the smaller towns in the state, not all, but it's comprised of the smaller towns in the state, like, you know, the Bethany's, the Bridgewater's, Colebrook. Surprise, Cromwell's a pretty good sized town that didn't have one, but, you know, some of the others, you know, again, Eastford, Hampton, Killingworth, Ledyard, Lisbon, Lyme. Clearly, you know, the prominence of those that don't have it are small communities, much smaller communities. So, yeah. And you know, the perception is that we don't have that problem here in this town, right? Well, you know what? You don't have a problem until you have a problem, and you have no way to deal with the problem because you don't have a code. So that's a specious argument. You know, we don't have those problems here. Well, you know, if you do wind up with it, you're going to have a problem. Because you don't have a process.
Yeah, just to illustrate, it's kind of interesting. I just met with someone from a small town. They're amending their ethics code, and they do have a provision there that would prevent employees contracting with their own departments. Now, so for example, you have a business, let's say you're an electrician, and you want to contract with your town. Sure, absolutely, you can contract with the Board of Education, you can contract with other departments, but not with your own. If let's say you are work for a fire department or for Parks and Recs and so on. And there was a lot of consternation because the folks, well, wait a minute, you know, they couldn't connect the fact that, well, it's kind of self-serving. If you are contracting without any bids with your own town, with your own department, that's a conflict.
You're right.
And again, no one is taking away bread from folks. You can still contract with the town, with other departments, provided you bid properly and so on. So
right,
but again, no, it's like this, and folks are just incredulous that you find opposition to something that's deemed to be ethics 101. I mean, right.
And you need to combine the ethics code with an effective purchasing policy as well, right? And outline your purchasing policy that, you know, you just can't give business to people because they're employed or they're but one of the challenges is a good number of the smaller communities, Guilford included, I won't call us small, but our current chairman of our Public Works Commission owns a sanitation business in town, and he has successfully bid for and won contracts to remove the sanitation from our buildings and schools, right? Mm-hmm. However, the last iteration, he failed to sharpen his pencil, and he didn't get the business because somebody else was more aggressive. So our policy precludes us from specifically going out and, you know, saying, okay, Mark, thanks for being chairman of Public Works Commission. By the way, here you go. You get all these contracts. So it really is. It's a layered approach, I think, is what you were talking about earlier. And it's not just the policy itself, but it has to be backed up by your purchasing policies as well. Well, quite honestly, I'd be happy to advocate once again at CCM and COST. I am on the board of directors at CCM. I'd be happy to advocate for continued support of this legislation if it's going to be brought back up again this year. Were you able to find out where the real resistance was in the House?
No, that's the House being a much bigger chamber. It's very tough. I mean, I talked to legislative leadership, and no one. I know there were a few people, a couple members of the GAP, who had some misgivings about that they've seen that bill as a mandate, state mandate, and even though we communicated to them that really the towns would be in the driver's seat on this. So I know a couple members who were straightforward and informed me that they were reluctant to support it. But regardless, I couldn't really pinpoint. I mean, ultimately, whether the bill is called or not, there has to be a decision made by the leadership or the caucus you know, with the recognition that there will always be someone who will oppose it, as long as the leadership finds it important, they will advance it, you know,
right.
And maybe somehow someone got to leadership's ear and the bill got stalled. And I know, especially when it happens in the final week of the session, there are many explanations as to why it wasn't called, because not enough time and so on. I mean, There are X number of explanations. All sound plausible, but
yeah,
ultimately, if there's a commitment to follow something, you know, if there's a will to pass something,
there's a way. There's a way. I've got some decent relationships with the majority leadership, and I'll be happy to have some conversations with the speaker relative to it, if that that makes any sense, or at least gauge his interest in seeing this through. Because I think, you know, your approach has been right on, is that every municipality should have one, and then let's talk about the opportunity to provide the safety net for the situations like Charles described earlier. And again, I'm not sure we would need to constitute a board for each cog. It might be something that was done on a statewide basis. Have you been able to track ethics complaints throughout the municipalities? Is that data that exists anywhere?
It's a good question. Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. Well, there's two sides to that question, right? There may not be very many complaints out there because people don't trust the process, right? Or they don't feel that they're going to get a fair shake at it in the fashion that Charles was talking about. So is there just a general reluctance, a lack of awareness and a reluctance to participate because the perception is it's a stacked deck, you can't fight City Hall?
Well, it could be like the voters who turn out in such low numbers, but then they're the first to complain when something goes wrong.
Yeah.
Matt, I have one more question. What are your thoughts about running with, because that's been raised in our past conversations, having a pilot project, volunteer pilot project for towns that may wish to pursue some form of an enforcement mechanism for their ethics concerns or even advisory questions. Let's say run it for, I don't know, 3 years and so on. It's still the details would have to be worked out, whether the Office of State Ethics would have the full jurisdiction over ethics matters, or just simply serve as an appeal board to consider, most likely the latter, being an appeal type of platform for towns in dealing with their ethics enforcement matters.
I think the latter. I think you have an easier sell if you postured as the appeal process. Because you haven't stripped home rule, you've sustained home rule, and we can take care of most of these things where we need to. But in the event that we are unable to do so, residents, constituents, citizens have an avenue beyond what Charles was afforded when he ran into a brick wall. So I would think, you know, I'm a huge fan of incrementalism. You take a little bit and you take a little bit and you take a little bit. Getting the full package where you guys are we set up some not appeal process, but a basic hearing process that all ethics complaints come in through through the state ethics office or these regional offices that are set up. Quite honestly, I'm not sure you get there in step one, but if you were able to start to lay the case out, as you said, with a pilot that we put together, you know, a 3-year pilot says, all right, this is an appeals court. I could clearly support something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very good idea. Good plan.
Yeah. Sounds good to me too.
Good. So I think we probably.
Well, the question is, where would you have the manpower to do this?
Well, that would have to be.
Does the manpower go
That's a very important question, because if we become an appeal board, then of course that would stretch, well, that would involve obviously the Citizens Ethics Advisory Board's engagement, but also in terms of staff, depending on how many towns are participants in it. And, you know, we have a finite time frame. If let's say we're talking about 3 years, with some planning, I think it would be important to probably limit the number of towns participation to, let's say, I don't know, 5 towns or what have you.
Yeah.
So it could be worked out, and you know, possibly, I don't know, additional funding could be obtained from the state to, for example, have part-time help, if or durational type of help, if necessary.
Yeah, or even contracted help, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
An advisory panel of attorneys, or you know, who would sit when needed, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's a better idea than trying to add a part-time person, in my opinion, because perhaps that part-time person, if they're relegated to dealing with ethics complaints for this pilot project, they might be sitting and doing nothing. You don't know if and when something is going to be happening.
Right.
Nobody's ever going to work for Peter and do nothing.
Well, no, but that's the whole thing. They've been hired for a specific reason. So are you treading lightly there as well? Whereas if you do something as Matt is suggesting, perhaps you're in touch with certain attorneys, assuming it's attorneys, that could make themselves available should they be needed for this 5-town project. And I was thinking 5 towns as well. You might not have anything, you might not have any complaints, or you might get a run at specific times of the year, whatever that might be, but then you'd have a go-to, and that makes sense to me.
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense to me.
Great. You know, now obviously if you expanded your universe beyond 5, and Peter is a crafty bureaucrat, he might look to have it as a full-time person, because there's probably other functions in the office that could use some additional resources. So he would bury the job description, split the job description, but I'm not suggesting.
Now you're making me think about
that. Crafty, very crafty devil.
That's right. You're adding resources because you're supporting the municipalities, not because you're growing a fiefdom, right?
I'm only doing it for the greater good.
Sorry for my Machiavellian
that's
thinking.
Right. That is correct. Matt, that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Throwing ideas back and forth, and I think that's a great idea.
Good. Well, let me know how I can be of any assistance, if I have been any at all.
You have been, absolutely. Great assistance. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt.
Yep. Thank you all.
Thank you, Matt.
Have a great weekend.
Throwing ideas around.
And if any of you are in Guilford,
this conference will now be recorded.
We have to have an official adjournment, so that's why.
So I move we adjourn.
So Matt's saying goodbye, and we're just going to continue.
And just remember, Matt, Machiavelli always got bad press. He wasn't.
Yeah, but he had a lot of outcomes that were favorable.
Right.
Cheryl, did you second that motion?
Did you second?
I'm sorry?
Did Cheryl, you second?
Oh, second. Yes, okay. Second.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Yeah, now we can turn it off. Thank you.
Okay. Have a great day, all.
Thank you.